during this lovely lunchtime slot, so we greatly are very aware that you have a choice of where to be right now, so we appreciate your being here with us now. So welcome to today's session. My name is Adrienne Griffin. I'm a project director at the Association of University Centers on Disabilities, and I'm really excited to be here today for this panel entitled Improving the Quality of Life of Youth in Transition. What I'll do is I'll introduce each of the speakers first, just to try to conserve some time for some nice interactive Q&A after the presentations. So in order of presentation, first up is Sue Lin, and she is currently a senior advisor at Health Resources and Services Administration, otherwise known as HRSA. And previously, she was an extramural research program officer for Maternal and Child Health Bureau, or MCHB. And prior to joining HRSA, she worked at the national and state level on research, education, and service and disability and public health. So we welcome you to today's panel. Thank you. And next up, we'll have Karen Ward. And Karen, as I understand, you're going to introduce your colleague. So I just have Karen's bio here right now, so I'll share that with you. So Karen is the director at the University of Alaska Anchorage Center on Human Development, and that is one of the university centers of excellence in developmental disabilities. That's USED. For those of us who are familiar with that acronym, that's one of my association's network centers. So we're excited to have you, and you work in your official designation is a professor of psychology, but you work in areas of disabilities, education, research, and service. So welcome to the panel today. Thank you. And next we'll have Laura Skeff. Is that correct pronunciation? Skeff? Great. Laura currently leads the disabilities area of expertise for the Alterium, is that correct? Alterium Institute, which is a nonprofit healthcare consulting firm. And she's also held a number of senior level positions in government and nonprofit sectors, most notably as the Commissioner of Social Services for the state of Minnesota, working on services for children, elderly, and individuals with disabilities. So we welcome you to the panel today. And last up on today's panel is Glenn White. Glenn has worked in rehabilitation and independent living for over 30 years, and many of you know him through his work in Kansas, where he directs the Research and Training Center in Independent Living at the university there. So welcome to today's panel. And you're also one of our USEDs. Yay! So without further ado, I'll turn it over to Sue, and I'll just sit right there with any time cue cards if you need anything.
I think so I'm okay.
You're good to drive? Okay.
I think I am.
Great. All right.
I hope so.
Yeah. Okay. Can everybody hear me okay? All right. Great. Thanks so much. Thank Adrienne for that kind introduction. And I want to just add my thanks for all of you being here at lunchtime. I know this standing between lunch and, you and lunch is probably, So for you to select to be here, we really appreciate you spending the time with us. I want to just quickly put some context into why I looked at this particular question. Has public health care benefits help level the playing field for children with special health care needs as they transition to adulthood? In May of 2012, the Princeton University and the Brookings Institute released a issue on the future of children. And in that issue, they looked at the impact of childhood disability. At that time, they were very interested in looking at federal benefits as it stood at that time. We all know that with the resources shrinking and the constraints of the resources, that our policymakers have been making efforts and strides to try to look at efficiencies and effectivenesses of these public benefit programs. That has led to a lot of anxiety within the community about what these changes mean and these transformations. And in particular, I think some of us are maybe familiar with Paul Ryan's plan about his push to thinking about making Medicaid into a block grant, which as a person that has worked in the Maternal and Child Health Bureau, the Title V of the Social Security Act was changed to the block grant, and a lot of times it just helps Congress do a across-the-board reductions. when funding is very limited. And so so there's a lot of anxiety along in the community about this. And so I felt like this is an important question to explore, especially for those kids that transition to adulthood. So one of the panels at the end of the day at that event in Brookings Institute was a senior staffer from the House who worked for a Republican congressman. And one of the questions he asked was, so can you tell me the return on investment? So it was a very difficult question to ask, and at the time, Maternal Child Health Bureau had funded this data set to look back at children that were surveyed in 2001 National Survey with Children's Special Health Care Needs. So I'll be sharing some of that data analysis with you today. So, all right, I have nothing to disclose. So Medicaid in the news, just I started talking about this a lot. A little bit already, sorry, that the House budget resolution for fiscal year 2013 called for dramatic cuts to Medicaid. It looked at, in terms of the block grant, if you're not familiar with it, placing a cap on the amount of funding that would go to the states. And a lot of the Republican governors were saying that, you know, this would give them a lot more flexibility to do some innovative programming. But as Medicaid stands now, if you're in a state and you have people eligible for Medicaid, it's an individual entitlement. So, you know, depending on how many people qualify for Medicaid in your states, there's no cap right now for those people that are receiving the benefits. So with the block grant, we can see, you know, what kind of impact that would make in the states and to individuals with disabilities. And also, you know, it potentially could result in no increases in keeping up with the healthcare inflation, which we've known had been a double-digit growth in the last, you know, the last years, and radically cut the federal share of Medicaid. So this is something that's very, very important. I wanted to look at it from the definition that MCHB developed for children with special health care needs, and I didn't know if some of you are familiar with it, but I'll just go ahead and reiterate what that definition is. So the Maternal and Child Health Bureau defines children with special health care needs to be those who have or at increased risk for chronic physical, developmental, behavioral, and emotional conditions, and who are also require health and related services of type or amount beyond that required by children generally. So this is a little bit on Medicaid eligibility, and some of you may be really familiar with. So very quickly, just a review for all of you. The child must meet the Social Security Administration definition of disability in order to be eligible for Medicaid. And among those that are, you know, listed within the Social Security Administration website discusses is not working at a job that we consider substantial work, has a physical or mental condition that results in marked severe functional limitations, and that the condition has lasted or expected to last at least 1 year or expected to result in death. So I don't know, those of you out in the audience, about you're familiar with transition. And so I wanted to highlight, why is transition difficult for youth with special health care needs? And this is really spanning what I consider both educational, employment, and health domains, and independent living domains. A lot of parents have told me that, you know, when the children age out of the educational system, it's like falling off a cliff. And in public health, we talk about a lot of cliffs that people fall off of. There's a sudden loss of services. There's also need for supports that we have not effectively been able to bridge that educational system to adult vocational rehabilitation systems. And there's a lot of challenges in the coordination of services. In terms of community living and independence, the public benefits that require new application processes, and so that can be very complicated for families to go through. There's also the needs for daily living skills development that in some cases, you know, some of these young youth may not be fully prepared of all the things that they'll need to have in order in place in order for them to achieve independent living. And they may need personal care, they may need case management. So this particular data set that I alluded to already is called the 2007 Survey for Adult Transition Health. So this data was collected over the telephone or via the internet. The funding for this data set was came from the Maternal and Child Health Bureau at the Health Resources and Services Administration, and it was conducted by CDC's National Center on Health Statistics, who is the MCHB's partner in our national survey data collection efforts. So this is, there are some limitations to this data that I wanted to highlight for you, because this was a, as I mentioned, it's a follow-back survey of those that were, whose parents responded to the survey in 2001, National Survey for Children's Special Health Care Needs. In 2001, these individuals were 14 to 17, and their parents had participated in the survey, and now they're adults in 2007, and so the NCHS worked to seek their consent to participate in the survey. Since we had not initially planned to do the follow-back survey, there was a lot of effort to try to locate the new residents of that young adult with special health care needs. And so you'll see that there's some limitations, and there's certainly non-response bias from this collection of the survey. But overall, about 1,800 of these young adults responded to the survey. So I think our suggestion to the field is that, you know, this is a data set to take a look at and can help, you know, explore and formulate hypotheses for other transition outcomes. So the statistical analysis, just very quickly, it's a secondary data analysis of the 2007 survey of adult transition health. I did perform both a bivariate and multivariate logistic regression analyses using SAS. Some of the results I wanted to share with you is comparing children with special health care needs without Medicaid and children with special health care needs with Medicaid, because I was specifically interested in looking at the Medicaid question. So as you'll see, the children with special health care needs with Medicaid are in blue, and then the children with special health care needs without Medicaid is in orange, or whichever color is conveyed on the screen. It looks orange to me. So you'll see that, you know, in terms of transition outcome in healthcare services, actually children with special health care needs with Medicaid had doctors that really helped them connect them to youth and adult mentors that have gone through the process. And so that's a positive news. You know, in terms of looking at doctors, whether they discuss, you know, how to keep their insurance or obtain insurance as adult, the children without Medicaid were at 54.3% of receiving that message from their doctors. This was a sort of an interesting question that I don't know what to make of it, is that in terms of doctors treating only children, teens, or young adults, those who are on Medicaid tend to have physicians who primarily treated children, teens, and young adults. They also children with special health care needs with Medicaid reported in the past 12 months they needed extra help in arranging care. But on the up note is that they did respond at a higher percentage of getting help in arranging or coordinating care. In terms of transition outcomes insurance coverage, these three questions really look at whether or not the health insurance benefits that they're receiving currently met their needs, whether the insurance allowed them to see providers as needed, and also pay any money for the health care out of pocket. So we'll see that across the board, the percentage of children without Medicaid report higher percentages of that their health insurance benefits met their needs, and those two other questions that I've already mentioned, and where children with Medicaid tend to report, they had lower percentages of reporting that their health insurance benefits met their needs. So that's a problem that we'll discuss towards the end of my presentation. As I mentioned, you know, the school and the vocation dimension is something that's very close and dear to my heart, because I started my career as a rehab engineer in a voc rehab agency, is, you know, the participation of those children with special health care needs in transition plan development, whether or not they obtained high school diploma and beyond, and then receiving vocational career training. And we see across the board on this bivariate analysis that children without Medicaid tend to do better. All right, I'm getting into the 5-minute mark. In terms of self-determination, this part, the questions looked at, you know, keeping appointments, choosing how to spend money, plan weekend activities, make choices that are important, and make friends, and then general life satisfaction. And again, we see sort of across the board that children without Medicaid tend to report that they were able to do these activities better than the children with Medicaid. And then in terms of the sort of the, what I categorize as the living situation, whether or not they received SSI or supplemental security income in the last 12 months, the children with Medicaid tend to report that they received SSI in the last month at 33% versus 5.7% for those without Medicaid. And then they also reported that they had more ability to pay for necessities than those without Medicaid. But then there's a significant larger portion of this of them reporting living with parents. And this may be a artifact of the non-response bias that I mentioned earlier, because in order to locate these individuals that if they were living with their parents, they were more likely to participate in the survey. So I'm just going to go through the multivariate analyses. I'm waiting for Adrian to give me the three-minute sign. In terms of the multivariate analyses, when we see that, you know, healthcare-related transition, we're seeing some good news. We're seeing that they're getting help in arranging and coordinating care. We see that, and the reference category is the children without Medicaid, that we're seeing that the doctors are helping them to connect with youth and adult mentors, which I think is very important in having somebody to guide you through that very complicated process. But there are some less positive news, and we sort of touched upon this in terms of the insurance adequacy that they face. Also similarly, for educational and vocational outcomes, we see that vocational areas that they have not received the vocational and career training of those without Medicaid, but in terms of participation in the transition planning, they seem to have higher odds of being able to do that. So I think the good news is that those that are on Medicaid benefits from this analysis, we're seeing that they're getting their usual source of care. They're getting arranged and coordinated care, and they're participating in transition planning. But there's still a lot of sobering news that we need to think about in terms of the access to vocational career training, the health insurance adequacy as an adult, and how those things would be addressed. And I think, you know, what we see from this analysis is that the children transitioned into adulthood who had Medicaid benefits, they were less likely to be independent, less likely to have autonomy financially and personally, and then less likely to have a social network in which they can draw upon social emotional support. Being at HRSA, we've been really careful to talk about sort of the impact of the Affordable Care Act. So I sort of temper my comments about, you know, what sort of policy implications that can come out of this. I think that the national state Medicaid directors have come up with some five strategies in which they're trying to contain the cost of Medicaid. And I think that before we take the lead to become transforming Medicaid into a block grant, that those efficiencies and effectiveness that can be achieved through these five strategies that the national state Medicaid directors have laid out should be fully evaluated, and that without taking a look at what they have in place and sufficient time to do program evaluation about the impact of those, we really can't make that decision, that drastic decision to make it into a block grant at this point. And so I would hope that the policymakers make a very, very thoughtful consideration before taking that leap. So with that, I will entertain questions and answers at the end.